I'm Jody, the mom.
And I'm Dr. Barr, the doc.
And this is Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas.
We bring together the mom experience and the doc expertise to give you the information and tools you need to help make the next right decision to get your child back.
Let's dive in.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Mom and Doc Talk. We are so happy to be joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Darren Ingalls, again. He joined us previously, a long time ago, to talk about Lyme disease, but he also happens to have some expertise in environmental medicine, so I had to bring him back so we could ask him all the questions about that, too. So if you missed the episode about Lyme disease, we'll link it in the show notes. But let me tell you just a little bit about him in case you haven't met him before. So Dr. Darren Ingalls is a licensed naturopathic doctor, author, international speaker, and leading authority on Lyme disease. He's a former Lyme patient who overcame his own 3-year battle with Lyme disease after having failed conventional treatment and became progressively debilitated. Dr. Ingalls found out proper diet, lifestyle management, and natural therapies worked with his body to heal instead of against it. He then applied what he learned about his own healing journey to his own Lyme patients and found they recovered faster and with less side effects. Dr. Ingalls has now treated more than 8,000 Lyme patients using his novel approach, many of whom have gone on to live healthy, symptom-free lives. Dr. Ingalls has been featured on WebMD, MindBodyGreen, Be Well, Thrive Global, Motherly, and Dr. Ron Hoffman's Intelligent Medicine podcast, and is the author of The Lyme Solution, a 5-part plan to fight the inflammatory autoimmune response and beat Lyme disease. So obviously, we are so grateful to have him join us. Welcome, Dr. Ingalls.
Oh, well, thank you for having me back.
So again, with some people have met you before on our podcast, but for those of them who haven't, please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to naturopathic medicine.
Well, I really came through naturopathic medicine, I'll say, not really by mistake, but my ex-wife actually had terrible migraine headaches, and she had endometriosis, and had seen conventional medicine really kind of fail her over and over again. You know, they were never interested in really looking at root cause, and it was just one drug after another, all which came with a lot of side effects. And we just happened to be on our honeymoon, and we met a woman in Hawaii who did, which we didn't know at the time, what we call craniosacral therapy, but mm-hmm. It actually got rid of her migraine. And I've never seen anything get rid of her headache. You know, at best, the medication would dull it. But it got rid of her headaches. And we eventually, at the time, we were living outside of Chicago, and we found another practitioner who did craniosacral who referred us to an acupuncturist. And that was a whole nother level of healing for her. And it was the acupuncturist that told me about naturopathic medicine. I was applying at the time to be a medical doctor or osteopathic doctor. I'd never heard of naturopathic medicine. But as I started looking into it, I'm like, wow, this is really more philosophically aligned to what we believe and what we were doing with our own health. Mm-hmm. And so I applied to naturopathic medical school and went to Bastyr University up in Seattle.
Yeah. We've never actually shared this story because I don't think I've actually talked to you about this before. And how I also came to naturopathic medicine as I was like taking my MCATs and like preparing to go to conventional medical school and figuring out that I was just going to have to like piece together something that was basically naturopathic medicine that I was figuring out I was going to have to do on my own. And then I accidentally found out about naturopathic medicine from like an article I read. And I was like, I thought somebody made up the title. And I was like, what the heck is this? And then I Googled it and I found my way to the school I went to, which was Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine, now called Sonoran University. I was also planning to go the conventional route, but didn't really fully align with the whole thing. So,
yeah, you know, it's kind of funny. I was a clinical microbiologist before I was a doctor, and I worked in a teaching hospital outside of Chicago. And it was kind of funny at the time because, you know, the doctors I worked with, none of them were recommending for me to go to conventional medical school. You know, they were seeing things change with managed care and kind of seeing how things operated. And it was funny because I worked in pathology, and it's not uncommon in pathology that a lot of pathologists come from other countries. It's mm-hmm. actually an easier residency. If you were trained in another country in medical school, it's a easier residency to get if you come to the United States and you want to get licensed here. So all the pathologists I work with, pretty much except one, came from another country who grew up with the tradition of what we might call naturopathic medicine. No, they grew up with herbs, they grew up with homeopathy, they grew up with these things as kids. So this was already kind of part of their own personal journey in medicine. So when I told them I was applying to naturopathic medical school, they're like, "Oh, great, that's wonderful. You know, go do that." So, it all worked out in the end.
So you are a fellow of the American Academy of Environmental Medicine. What got you interested in this specific area, the environmental side of things?
Well, I was fortunate to have been a student of Walter Crinian, our
So
one of
was
our
I.
friends who has since passed away. But he taught my environmental medicine classes in naturopathic medical school, and as I'm sitting there, you realize this literally applies to everything. Everything in human health, the impact of food, the impact of chemicals in the environment, the impact of pesticides and herbicides and toxic metals like lead and mercury, it just made so much sense to me that this is really kind of the crux of what I think at least harms humans and often stops people from getting well. And I was very lucky, I think it was kind of by accident, when after I finished my residency and I moved to Connecticut, the doctor I was working with was supposed to go to the American Academy of Environmental Medicine conference, and she couldn't go. And she's like, "Hey, I've already paid for it. Do you want to go?" And I'm like, "Sure, yeah, that sounds great." And I went, and I'm sitting there with these doctors that have practiced for 30, 40 years, had all of this experience, just, I mean, vast amounts of knowledge. I mean, I was just blown away and how much I learned in that one weekend relative to what I'd learned, throughout my at least medical school education. And that just kind of got me in, and I'm like, wow, it's to be able to sit there with, experienced, seasoned doctors dropping these, pearls of information, and then also realizing how much of this information goes back decades. The American Academy of Environmental Medicine actually started out as the Society for Clinical Ecology, which was developed by Theron Randolph, who was one of the really the founders of environmental medicine back in the 1940s or 50s. And you go back and you read these old textbooks about them talking about the side effects of food dye that was new to the American food supply. They were already talking about the impact of chemicals in our food. And of course, they were considered the crazy quack people at the time because, oh, no, the FDA says they're fine, they're safe. So, there's this very long tradition of environmental medicine going back now almost, 90 years, 80, 90 years of recognizing the impact of our environment on human health. And so, again, it just resonated and made so much sense. And, every day in my practice, we are applying some aspect of environmental medicine with our patients.
Dr. Ingalls, I was very excited to see this conversation coming about because my world has been immersed in kind of chemicals and how they impact my children and a little bit my Pans girl, but I've got a younger mast cell kiddo that was really, really severe. And there was such a strong impact, environmental, chemical, all of those things. So when thinking about our conversation, like, can we start at the very beginning for those of us that are kind of new to this conversation? And can you define what a chemical is and really kind of the difference between our chemical world today as opposed to our chemical world years ago that we grew up in?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's no mystery that as time has gone on, and really since the Industrial Revolution, the advent and use of chemicals for various reasons, and some of them make sense, some of them not so much. But as different industries are looking to maintain shelf life, to maintain the durability of a product, the introduction of plastics into our daily living. I mean, for food storage, for making tires, for there's all sorts of different applications. Go back 100 years, we just didn't have access to these things. These things really hadn't been developed yet. And I think, a lot of these chemicals out there were initially designed probably with some very good intent, that in some way was going to improve the well-being and lives of people. But we've learned that as we've gone on time, that that's not always the case. I think, particularly if we start getting into chemicals like pesticides and herbicides, back in the days, farming was done in a very organic way. Farmers learned how to rotate their crops. They, now we call it regenerative farming, but I mean, that was what farmers
It was
did
just
back then.
farming back in
It was
the
just farming when they didn't rely on chemicals to grow their crops, to keep pests at bay. They came up with other ways to maintain their crops and grow food appropriately. And of course, as time has gone on, certain big companies like Monsanto figured out, hey, we can genetically alter a seed so that if you don't use our pesticide, the seed doesn't grow. And it really became honestly more about money and profits and not necessarily about human health. And we sort of break chemicals down into two parts. We have what we call toxins, which are kind of natural toxic things in our world, and toxicants, which are artificially or man-made toxins to the human body. And so, there could be toxins that you get from, if you get salmonella poisoning, that bacteria makes a toxin that makes you sick. But things like, glyphosate or Roundup is a toxicant. It is an artificial, man-made chemical that harms human health. And if you consider the average American gets exposed to over 88,000 chemicals a year, less than 200 of those have actually been studied for their long-term safety. And so we have no clue what happens when you add the totality of all these things that you get exposed to, and what does it do to your cells at its most basic level? What does it do to cell repair? How much do these things potentially damage the cell? And so, if we start seeing, these increases in chronic disease, cancer, diabetes, metabolic health, autism, on and on and on, there is at least some connection with chronic chemical exposure. And as humans, we are designed to get rid of chemicals, to get rid of toxins. We have this thing called detoxification between our liver and our kidneys and sweating, and we breathe out these things. So we have this inherent ability to do that. But, I think going back to the beginning of mankind, we didn't get exposed to that many toxins, that many chemicals. So we have asked our bodies to deal with more and more and more, and it just gets worse every year. And I think, it's a big driver behind a lot of chronic illness. So, we talk a lot about, well, how do we mitigate or manage chemicals? Well, I mean, you can around your house to a certain degree, but once you step outside that front door, it becomes a whole different ball of wax. And, trying to control what everyone else in your neighborhood does, what the governments do, it's a big, big problem. So I think, if we're going to turn the tide on getting people healthier as a whole, we've got to start finding ways to reduce the total body burden that we're all getting exposed to on a regular basis so that we're not asking our body to have to process so much junk.
Right. I always tell people that, when people will say, oh, the amount of toxins that we're exposed to today or how toxic this world is, like we've in recent history, like post-industrial revolution, toxicants have been part of our life, right? And our
Right.
body can handle them. And I also understand and agree, like, that when we get to like the volume that we might be regularly exposed to and the places that they show up that are different. And so that's why I'm really glad that you're here, so we can at least talk about the things we can do and the things we can control, and what impacts we might be able to make so that we can help people be as healthy as possible in the environment, like in the water that we're swimming in, right?
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you brought up, because so many people seem to forget that our body does have the ability to process toxins, and like there's ways that we can support the body to do that as effectively as possible while also limiting our exposure. But there's only so much that we can control, as you've just said. So let's talk about that a little bit more. So let's first start with telling us some of the ways that people might be able to tell if they are chemically sensitive, because it's not always really super clear.
Well, the most obvious thing is that when people get around certain chemicals, and just as an example, for people like go to the mall and they feel nauseous, they get dizzy, they start getting headaches, they walk into Yankee Candle shop that's just all these toxic chemicals they put into, a candle. when you start to notice that you get around perfume and cologne and any kind of strongly scented anything that, wow, I don't feel good, that is a sign of chemical sensitivity. You know, people go to the gas station to pump gas, and just standing there for, 5 minutes to fill your car up, the fumes that come out sometimes will make people feel unwell. So the being around the presence of these different chemicals, if you start to notice that, you start to get any kind of physical, mental, emotional change in the way you feel, that's usually the most obvious sign. And, to a certain degree, your capacity to detoxify often dictates how sensitive you may or may not be to any chemical. I think, we all have our threshold. Anyone gets exposed to enough of any one chemical, it will get to a point where it will make you sick. There are some people who can have a very high exposure and have little no to no impact on their health, and other people get a little exposure and they feel horrible. And the best way I can equate it, it's kind of like coffee, right? You're gonna have someone who drinks a sip of coffee and they get nervous and jittery and their heart's racing, and then there's the person who drink a pot of coffee and it has no impact on them at all. So again, it just kind of speaks to how well your detox pathways work. A lot of that to a certain degree is genetic, but it's also, again, the amount of load on the body. So, it's usually obvious to people. I mean, the people that come in my clinic who are chemically sensitive, they know. I mean, they've had the experience of being around or being in different environments where there are different chemicals, and they know the way that they feel when they're around them. And then they get out of that environment and they usually feel a lot better.
Well, you have some people who might not necessarily know, or might not connect two and two together, or might just be, stubborn or whatever it might be. And I'm thinking specifically of my husband when I say stubborn. I love him very much, but he's also a very stubborn person. And I was thinking of him specifically as like my example that I might give to somebody, is that, my husband and I can go for a walk at like a, or a hike, and somebody can walk by him or hike by him and have, used like a scented detergent on their clothes, and he has a raging headache just because that person walked by them. I feel like I would need to swim in a pool of perfume to not feel well, because I'm just not as affected by those by things as he is. So like, and he also has, I don't know, we might have a genetic difference in like just our abilities, but he also worked in an environmental field where he was using, he actually sprayed glyphosate on things at some points, and like used lots of other like weed killers and whatnot in some of the work that he did in conservation. So he's also had a lot more exposure. So exposure plus explode, like any, while he was working in conservation, he also ate like a, like worse than standard American diet, like all the processed things. So he just wasn't doing the things he needs to do to take care of his body. So it's like a both and sort of situation for a lot of people.
Yeah, and there can be some toxins again that are a bit more insidious. I mean, I think about like mycotoxins, people who live in water damaged buildings who it's a slow, insidious exposure where over time it builds. And
And you
in
might not
many
notice.
cases, it's not obvious to people that that's what's bothering them. It may take many months or even years to get to a point where, it starts to bother them. But, I hear this all the time when, people find out they've got mold in their home. There's five people in the family, two people are really affected, and the other three aren't bothered at all. Again, I think it just speaks to how well each person is able to clear these toxins. But for the people who are sick, it's rarely a case where it happened quickly. Usually, it's these things that happen over the course of a longer period of time where their health just slowly started to decline and then finally figured out it was related to some mold damage.
So I'm channeling moms that are watching right now, and I know the question out there. At least a couple of moms are thinking, well, what does this look like in my kid? How do I know if my kid is chemically sensitive? And so I just wanted to mention a couple of symptoms that my kids dealt with, so we can they can think about it like that. So whenever my children were exposed, it was things like getting really red cheeks or really red ears. It was seeing little splotchy hives on the skin. It was GI stuff. It was behavioral stuff. So I think it can manifest in a lot of different ways
Absolutely.
in our kids. And like what we actually see, oftentimes we attribute it to something else. Like I was always finding, oh, it was this or oh, it was that, until I got far enough down the road where I was like, holy cow, like every time she's around someone who is wearing perfume or cologne, she's having GI symptoms, which I would have never thought that GI symptoms would come from something like that. So I think it can look like a lot of different things, and really just
Yeah.
keeping it open to consideration. So specifically, pandas kids, how often do you see chemical sensitivity in pans kids?
I'd say the overwhelming majority of kids with PANS have some element of chemical sensitivity. And I think it all comes down to, again, this mast cell activation. Everything you just described with your own kiddos, the red cheeks, the red ears, flushing, nausea, often that is a mast cell activation event. And we know that mast cells are activated by allergens, they're activated by pathogens, and they're activated by toxins. So when kids get around these toxic exposures, again, you can get this mast cell activation that can translate to, like I said, GI stuff, skin stuff, neurocognitive behavioral things. So, much like we see with PANS of sort of this acute onset, stuff. That's one of those things that is a big red flag that, okay, we know there's an underlying trigger, and now we just have to figure out, what those triggers are.
Yeah. I would say that, like, sort of like what you were saying, Jody, that you were essentially talking about susceptibility, right? And we've been talking around susceptibility, all of us, with using different words. So there's the genetic predispositions, which is part of your susceptibility. There's the susceptibility to having different presentations for things. And then there's also the thing that can occur with PANS kids that we see so frequently is that there's one trigger, but then it generally expands unless you've addressed the susceptibility, because we it's not just like it's not just strep that's the problem. It's not just mycoplasma that's the problem. It's not just mold that's the problem. That might have been the initial trigger, but eventually, if anything that triggers an immune response is going to trigger these symptoms that you're susceptible to. So that's why we see it in so many PANS pandas kids. Some people, it's their initial trigger, but a lot of times it's just an expansion of like anything that's triggering an immune response. And so, yeah, I agree. Most kids that we see who have PANS pandas have some degree of chemical sensitivity. And there's a lot of families who like mold is what people always go to. But that's why I wanted to bring you on, is it's not always mold. Like, just because it's like happening in, it's not always a moldy classroom. It could be the chemicals being used to clean the classroom. It could be that the teacher is wearing like that uses like the most fragrant detergent in her clothes, and like everybody around them uses the fragrant detergent in clothes. It could be a fragrance that's plugged into the room, so it's not always mold. It might actually be chemicals, and these are chemicals are in most cases a much easier thing to deal with, at least removing and avoiding, than mold is. So let's start with like diving into this a little bit deeper. So there's lots and lots of different chemicals and even types of chemicals that can affect folks who are sensitive, like we were just talking about. So where would you start to evaluate for someone to like help identify what's going on and what might be a problem for them?
Unfortunately, testing isn't always very reliable. And of course, there's so many chemicals out there in the world. It's not even possible to test for everything. I mean, to be honest, I mean, there are labs out there that do offer different types of tests that look at phthalates, different types of plastics. They look at, volatile organic compounds or VOCs and a lot of these other things. And the reality is that most people will come back with something. It's expected. So I don't know that I find it terribly useful as a guide on how we need to approach treatment. We just accept that we're all exposed to chemicals. So it's really about how do we, again, minimize the impact on our kids. And, as I start with the low-hanging fruit, start at the home, start with the things that you can control, start moving everything in your home to non-toxic, non-scented stuff. I've seen, so many people that those little things make such a big difference when they, stop using the scented laundry detergent and the scented shampoos, and they stop the Glade plug-in in the bathroom and all these kind of things. Because again, it's death by a thousand cuts. It's just those little impacts over and over that as you keep getting control over each one of those, the impact on the body is less and less. So, Think about everything from the food in your home to the cleaning chemicals you're using. Get rid of the Windex, get rid of the 409, get rid of Mr. Bubbles and Mr. Clean. And there are plenty of good, non-toxic, natural ways to keep your house clean and sparkly. And if you really feel like you need a scent, you can use a natural essential oil. There's always a great substitute on getting rid of the toxic stuff for non-toxic stuff. And it's simple, it's easy, it doesn't break the piggy bank, but again, it can have a big impact on your whole family's health by just cleaning up the home. And there's some really great resources out there. The Environmental Working Group, EWG.org, has an online resource where you can find non-toxic sunscreens and different things to use around the home. They publish every year what they call the Dirty Dozen, the top 12 most toxic or heavily pesticided foods. It's like, okay, well, maybe I don't have to eat all organic, but at least for the ones that are the most toxic, I'll eat those organic, and the rest of the ones maybe are not so bad. So there's a couple of books out there, like Deborah Lynn Dadd wrote a book called Home Safe that also talks about different swaps for pretty much everything you could use in and around the home for a more natural, non-toxic alternative.
And I think any mom that just listened to this and was like, oh my gosh, I have to do it all at one time. The practical application of this in our homes is just doing the best that we can. Because once I realized that my daughter was literally couldn't leave our home, and also our home was attacking her too, the best I could do at the time was a small thing at a time. And over time, stop buying the products, just change your product next time you have to purchase it. And doing this in little steps, little, I had to move through it in little bitty increments so it wouldn't be overwhelming for me. It wouldn't be financially overwhelming. And little bits over time, we eventually got our house to pretty much 100% chemical free. But I couldn't do that all in one wave. And I don't think, that is a very, very overwhelming even idea or thought to think about. But I think as we go along, if we can get a little more and a little more chemical free in our environment and our homes, the better.
Yeah, I agree. It's a journey, and I've got some moms that are just warrior moms, and they go in and they just clean house and get rid of all the stuff. But you're right. There's a lot going on in your world, and the idea of trying to transfer your entire house in a day is probably not practical for most people. So again, it's a journey, it's a goal. That's what you're shooting towards. And each, day, each week, it's like, okay, here's one more thing we can swap out. Here's another toxic thing we can get rid of. And you just That's the end game. You just keep working towards that.
So are there chemicals or groups of chemicals that you find that Pan's kids are more affected by?
Well, mold and mycotoxins is probably one of the top, just because it's so prevalent. And what we find, even if your home is safe, we find that a lot of schools have terrible mold issues, no matter where you are in the country. It's just the nature of how schools are designed, the age of the school. And of course, it's never in a school budget to actually clean and maintain, the ductwork and their air conditioning system or whatever they've got in place. So, I see schools as being one of the biggest culprits, because I see this all the time again in my practice, where kids are doing pretty good in the summertime, and man, the minute they're back in school, they're a hot mess again. And it's just now they're getting exposed to potentially mold, like I said, the cleaning stuff that they use in the classrooms or in and around the school. And if you've got a chemically sensitive child, they'll feel the impact of that. So as much as you keep your home safe, you can't really control what's going on in the school system. So mycotoxins are very common. Again, I find other, strongly scented products, perfumes and colognes and things like that. Most kids do not do well in and around any of that. Other, what we call VOCs, volatile organic compounds, that are in a lot of different things. I mean, I'm thinking about one of the kids I was working with that he used to have a lot of, cognitive problems, focus issues, and we finally figured out that he was sitting in the very first row of his classroom, and in the classroom they used dry erase markers. And so he was right up next to the teacher, who kept opening these dry erase markers, which contain toluene and other chemicals, and just him breathing that in. And so mom just asked him, can you just move him to the back of the class? They moved him back in class, and he did great. He just needed some distance from that constant exposure to dry erase marker. So you go, well, gosh, it's just such a little bit, a little bit of poison for the wrong person. It's too much. So, I mean, that was just a good example of you just never know. So again, as much as we can limit that exposure, the better.
Yeah. So we've been talking a lot, mostly about chemicals that you could breathe in, and that's how it gets into your body. It's been in the news a lot about plastics and microplastics,
Yeah.
nanoplastics specifically. What are your thoughts about plastics in particular? Just because it's in so many places, and people, I think, go on rampages clearing out all of the bottles of chemicals that they're cleaning with, and then they're sticking their kids' food in plastic containers and sending them to school.
Well, we know, like, certainly something like phthalates, and you'll see all these things now. BPA, bisphenol A is a type of phthalate, and you'll see BPA free, which often is misleading because they swapped out BPA for BPS. It's like,
Which is just
hey,
as bad and potentially worse.
yeah, it's like, hey, I'm not going to use lead, I'm going to use mercury. I'm like, thank you. You've traded one toxic thing for another toxic thing. So, we know that the harder the plastic, the less likely it is to leach the phthalates into whatever surrounding it, whether it's water or food. So, like the hard Nalgene bottles are probably not as bad as those very soft, squishy ones you get at the supermarket, like the Poland Spring and those kind of water bottles. Obviously, soft plastic in heat is a terrible combination. And I think about living here in California where people are preparing for earthquakes. So you'll see people stock up on these water bottles to have. And of course, they sit in your garage where it gets hot, and now you're leaching all this plastic into the water. I'm like, that would not be the best way to store water. So as much as we can move people to glass, stainless steel, things that aren't going to leach chemicals into your food or your water is obviously preferable. The reality is plastic is part of our world and it's hard to avoid. And I'm always shocked when I'm at the supermarket to see how they'll take even organic food and then shrink wrap it in plastic. I'm like, you realize that is like the dumbest thing in the world. So as much as you can avoid things that are shrunk wrap in plastic, packaged in plastic, it's really, really hard to avoid it completely. So again, it's about reducing it as much as possible. So at home, invest in ceramic, invest in glass, invest in stainless steel to store your food after you've cooked it so that it's not sitting in plastic, even while it's sitting in the refrigerator. Don't ever put plastic, obviously, in a microwave and those kind of things. It's going to melt and just make your food even more toxic. So, again, I don't know that we can get rid of plastics completely, but
Any of these things,
yeah.
any of these things,
Again, it's about minimizing it as much as possible. But again, it's really easy to go, we went out and just went to, I think, the container store and just bought a bunch of glass and ceramic containers, and that's what we store all our food in. And if we do need to reheat it, you pop it in the oven, it's fine, it's easy. So something like that is a really easy way to try and get around a lot of the plastic stuff.
Well, something that's interesting too is that, like, along with the reports about the microplastics, nanoplastics being in basically everywhere, that I've seen reports about just, like, things that I'm sure we'll talk about here in just a few minutes, but like that you can actually help remove them to a degree just by eating more fiber.
Yeah.
And it's just so, it's so. There's some things that we can do that are just so simple that are just like removing obstacles to health and focusing on the things that promote health in general can
Yeah.
also help with some of these things because our body has this really innate ability to like help process things out. But like I said, we'll get there. I feel like I read somebody's one of our listeners' minds when you're talking about water. If you had to choose between city water and all the things that can come with city water versus bottled water, which would you choose?
I'd still go with city water. I
Same.
mean, for better, for worse, and every city water is different. I mean, I live in Irvine, California. I think our tap water, I mean, I would not prefer to drink it. We filter our water. But when I go to Portland, Oregon, the tap water there is amazing. And you can taste the difference. I don't know what they do to their city water, but they have like the best tap water I've ever had in the country. So again, depending on your municipality, some waters are better than others, but at least there are some standards in municipal city water that it's going to be relatively clean and it is drinkable. where I worry less about some of the stuff because we know a lot of cities add chlorine and other things to the water supply. But yeah, if we're kind of comparing toxicities, I would worry much more about the plastic.
Okay.
What's your general approach to treating chemical sensitivity?
Yeah, so in our practice, we actually test people for chemical sensitivity, and then we do different types of immune therapy to desensitize them against the chemicals. Again, with the understanding that some of these chemicals you may not be able to avoid, things like formaldehyde and phenol that's going to pretty much every new product. It's in paint, it's in carpet, it's in upholstery, it's in clothing. You know, they put it in to maintain the integrity of these fibers so they don't break down as quickly. So that, you know, new car smell or new furniture smell is usually the outgassing of formaldehyde and or phenol. And again, I've had people say, I go to the mall, I get a headache, I get dizzy, I get nauseous. So if we can't always control the environment, can we change the way people respond to the environment? And we found, you know, immunotherapy can be a very effective way to help modulate that response. You know, people may not like it. They'll know when they're in an environment and say, oh, yeah, I don't like it. I don't like the smell. But that's different than like having a physical or mental, emotional reaction that actually becomes somewhat disabling. So, you know, we'll test people through different means. And if you find out you're sensitive to petroleum or benzene or toluene or whatever it is, you know, we typically do sublingual immunotherapy. These are drops that go under the tongue. The concept's very much like allergy shots. You know, if you go to the allergist and they find out you're allergic to dust or ragweed, you would go in every week and they would inject you with dust or ragweed at a very specific concentration. And at that concentration, it kind of turns off that immune reaction to whatever you're giving. So the idea here is the same. It's just we're doing it for chemicals versus, you know, more conventional allergens.
To desensitizing it. Yeah.
I mean, I'm working with she's not a child. I mean, she's an adult, but she used to be in the military. And you know, anyone who served in the military, they get exposed to lots and lots of bad stuff. And so, you know, she became chemically sensitive because of her time in the military. She's now out of the military and she's older, but she's now left with this chemical sensitivity. So, you know, we're treating her for a lot of different chemicals. But over time, you know, now she can go out and be in the world and it's not as bad. Again, she doesn't get the headache she was getting before. She doesn't get the nausea. She used to get really kind of disoriented. Like she's like, I'd be driving down the street. She was telling me they were repaving her street and or her neighborhood, and just the tar from the asphalt, you know, the fumes that come off it. She's like, I would be driving in my neighborhood and I'd forget where to turn to get back to my house. That's really scary if you get disoriented like that, especially when you're driving. So, you know, this has been really helpful as a way to try and help, again, curtail some of that reaction.
Yeah. You had mentioned testing being unreliable. What sort of testing do you actually trust?
Well, in terms of testing people for exposure to chemicals, that I really honestly don't do because we're all exposed. I mean, I have some patients, you know, like, well, can you test me for glyphosate? I'm like, I can. You know, there's a lab that does that. You're probably going to have something unless you eat all organic in your urine.
And
So
you never drive past a farm that uses it.
yeah. So just knowing again that people have that exposure, again, I don't really I don't even bother doing these tests. They tend to be pretty expensive. And at the end of the day, I don't think it changes our treatment approach, knowing that we're all exposed to chemicals. And, you know, I know there's kind of a fad and social media people that, you know, promote doing a 3-day detox, a 7-day detox. You know, let's do this quick detox of whatever it is. But the reality is that detox needs to be something that you're doing on an ongoing basis. We're always exposed. And the idea that we're just going to dump all this stuff in a week or two and everything's going to be great. I mean, some of these programs might be great as sort of a kickstart to a longer term approach. But I think, again, we need to think of it as what do we do on an ongoing basis to keep our bodies getting rid of that stuff and while minimizing the input to it.
Yeah, and I think it's really hard to, when I was going through it with the beginning of my mast cell girl, this was 2012 to 2016-ish time, and there wasn't a whole lot of education about the chemical stuff yet. So
Yeah.
it's a little different now. But we went to doctors and we did a bunch of testing, and the multiple doctors that we were seeing and doing testing with were all like, no, like everything's fine. There's nothing wrong with her. She's good. There's no way. And so, in my mom opinion, the best test out there was what I was actually seeing and the actual, exposure reaction.
Right.
And it's a hard thing to do whenever providers are telling you, nope, it's not a thing. It's not it. It's not happening. So I would encourage anyone who is going through that to trust what you're seeing, because the reaction is the exposure and reaction is the best test available, and to keep seeking answers from a provider that will listen to you and work with you and understand really what your kid's dealing with.
Yeah, we really don't do it much in our practice just because it's a bit complicated. But Dr. Doris Rapp, I don't know if you know Dr. Rapp. Dr. Rapp was a pediatric allergist in Buffalo, New York. And for 25 years, she videotaped every kid that came in her practice. And she would inject them with a little intradermal injection of what she thought was provoking them. And then she would observe them for 10 minutes. And then she would keep doing this until you would turn the reaction off. And she wrote a book. Well, she wrote several books, but she wrote one called "Is This Your Child?" And then she wrote another one called "Our Toxic World." But if you ever get a chance to find videos of her and some of these cases where you would inject a kid again with toluene, and you'd just see them, she would have them like draw pictures or write something, and you would see initially everything looked pretty good, and then after she would inject them with whatever the chemical was, their handwriting would fall apart. The picture that was a nice sunny picture is now a dark, kind of ugly picture. And then when she eventually turned the reaction off, it would go back to being a nice picture and nice handwriting. So we call this provocation neutralization, where you provoke the person by injecting with the thing that you think is causing the problem, and then you neutralize the reaction, give them the right dose. And that also tells you what the treatment dose is over time. But it was so powerful for parents to see this in real time, that this is what happens to your kid when they get exposed to whatever it is that you give them the injection of. And it's just a shame that there's very few doctors who do this anymore, just because it's so labor intensive. And of course, insurance doesn't pay for it, and it takes a lot of time. But again, if you can find practitioners that do it, it is incredibly, again, powerful to see how each of these individual things. So again, you can do it for food, you can do it for chemicals, because again, a lot of parents have no idea what happens when their kid really eats wheat or when they eat dairy. You might think, well, maybe it does this, but do we really know? But yeah, when you give them wheat and you see their behavior change, or they complain of getting a headache, or they start to fall asleep in the chair, now you know this is actually what it's doing to them.
So when we talk about anything related to environmental medicine, binders always come up in conversations. And I personally am really concerned about navigating binders with kids, especially with the kids who have like ARFID, and
Yeah.
so they have really limited diets. And some of the binders that people are using, and like they're just because somebody told them about it, or they heard another parent about it, are really strong and they can actually bind vital nutrients. So when you combine a binder that can bind vital nutrients in a kid who has a restricted diet and is
Yeah.
probably already limiting their nutrient intake, and usually the restricted diets, they're usually beige foods, right? It's rare that you got a kid whose restricted diet is I'm only going to eat vegetables that are like very colorful. It's beige foods. So fewer nutrients and usually the processed synthetic nutrients, right? That themselves have their own problems. So how do you navigate the use of binders?
I don't.
You don't use them.
Nope. I mean,
Hallelujah. I don't use them either. Like I don't recommend them.
here's the bottom line on binders. Well, first of all, as you mentioned, binders do exactly what they do, and they often are binding. And I see a lot of kids in particular, but some adults, when they go on binders, they get horribly constipated, they get a lot of gas, they get a lot of bloating, get a lot of side effects from it. And honestly, like I said, fiber is the best natural binder. I'd rather just people increase fiber in their diet, eat more fresh fruits and vegetables, nuts, seeds,
Drink more
legumes.
water.
But more importantly, I mean, from a science standpoint, I mean, there's literally like no research on any of these binders doing what they say that they do. I think it's one of these things that Richie Shoemaker started many years ago and talked about binders for like mold and mycotoxins and other things. But when you actually get into the weeds of the science, you realize that, I mean, like bentonite clay or activated charcoal, I mean, these are used in hospitals for acute, like, toxicity from drug poisoning, which actually is to bind it in the stomach, not the intestines. So there are cases where binders should be used, but it's not usually the cases of what most people are using binders for. So it's become this big thing in functional medicine, and I'm not sure why. I've talked a lot with Dr. Andrew Campbell, who runs a lab that tests for mycotoxins, but he is a toxicologist, and he kind of agrees that there just isn't good evidence of using these binders. And when you look at zeolite and a lot of these other things that get promoted, that they're going to magically bind all things. And if you think about it too, your liver has a way, when you get exposed to a toxin, it gets conjugated in the liver, it gets bound up in the liver to another compound like glutathione or sulfate or a methyl group, and it binds it so that your body doesn't reabsorb it and it gets rid of it. You can imagine if we didn't have that process, we'd never get well because these toxins would just keep recirculating over and over and over. So we already have a built-in mechanism to get rid of toxins. And I think, I have this, I'll say, spirited discussion with a lot of my colleagues around mycotoxins. 90% of mycotoxins get excreted through the kidneys, the urine. They don't go through the gut. So why get
Binders
a
aren't even doing
binder in the
anything.
gut for something that's going through the kidneys? It just doesn't make any biological sense. And so, I've seen more harm than good with binders. I've had some patients who tell me they take binders and they feel great. I think the mechanism's probably different than what they think it is. Does it do anything to alter the microbiome? Does it do anything to alter gut pH? Is there some other mechanism that has nothing to do with actually binding a toxic chemical and getting rid of it? Probably, would be my guess. But the lack of really good research on these binders and the fact that they're used so indiscriminately, and again, I've seen more disappointments with them than help. So I don't use them.
I really wish we could shift the conversation. I see it so much in the PANS community. I wish we could. I feel like the binders conversation that I see so often is so surface level. And I really wish we could go deeper. And instead of saying, how do I get these things out of my body? We could ask the question, why isn't my child's body doing this properly? And that's the thing that we need to go after. We don't need to go like continuously give binders because the body's not getting rid of these things. We need to fix the reason why it's not doing those things. Again, I always like I'm back at susceptibility again and like root problem and why isn't the body doing this properly?
Well, and we need to also add in what we were talked about earlier, the unreliability of tests. Like, especially like the specialty labs that you're paying out of pocket for are generally less reliable in many cases than the others. And like, it's that they're not fully like unreliable. Like, you're always going to get a false positive, but you're more likely to get a false positive too, right? So we're potentially looking at something that might be unreliable, and then taking a surface level of like, for whatever reason, binders are sexy now, right? Like, and so everybody's using them and everybody wants them. But are they actually doing the thing that you need them to do? And I always, as we said, we always go back to basics and we always go back to susceptibility, because if we remove obstacles to health, so if we're removing the chemicals where we can, like the things we can control, and we're promoting healthy behaviors, like we're eating more fiber, we're drinking water, we're getting enough sleep so that our body can actually, so much of our detox processes happen when we're sleeping, especially in the brain, right? And so if we're focusing on these like foundations for health, and then stimulating the body to heal or desensitizing to like known or like likely known chemicals, then we're going to do a better job of our body overall, like more health promotion. Because the reality is, like some of these supplements, even if you're like taking herbs to like help your with your liver, if you're especially if you're not doing it under the guidance of a trained professional who knows the herbs, knows the company that's making them, knows their like process, guys, some of these herbs are actually getting you more toxic. These herbs that are trying to help your liver can actually be harming your liver more than if you took nothing at all. So many of them, right? So these are things that people don't always consider, especially when they're doing things on their own. So Let's go back to, like, we always have to talk about homeopathy because that's our expertise and that's our focus. We want to talk about all things around it. So I know that you value homeopathy in your practice, and I'm curious what role you've seen homeopathy play in helping with environmental triggers for Pan's Pandas. And of course, I'll share what my thoughts are as well, but I'm curious your
Well, you know, again, in Hahnemann's time, chemicals were not much of a problem. You know, I think, you know, it's been harder to get the effects of some of the remedies. I mean, again, my experience, I find often we have to dose a little bit more frequently because we're constantly trying to override what, you know, the environment is pushing against. So I find that I have to dose a little bit more frequently, but again, homeopathy can still work brilliantly. And the fact that we're, you know, treating the whole person, again, I'm not a purist that, you know, I only do homeopathy and nothing else. I see it as a
great one of your tools.
Integration tool with everything else. But as we're working on, again, cleaning up the home, cleaning up the environment, helping our kids detox, again, this is a great therapy that's going to help the whole person get well. So, you know, I think, you know, when you're doing homeopathy for anything, you know, as much as you can clean house, so to speak, it's just going to give that remedy a better opportunity to hit the right core of your vital force and stick. Because when you see you're getting that little bit of action, but it's not lasting, and then you redose, and again, you get a little of action, it's not lasting. It's like, okay, yeah, maybe we can go up in potency, but maybe it's just that there's something else that's pushing against your vital force that's like a block. And if we can get that block out of the way, now that remedy, you know, works much, much more effectively.
Right. And that's why I wanted you to join us, because what you're talking about is removing obstacles. So homeopathy is not just about giving the remedy. It is about removing obstacles to health. And then the once you've done that, stimulating the body to heal. And they can be done simultaneously, especially for complex chronic illness. Like, you can be working on both at the same time. And I've personally seen some people that homeopathy alone, plus obviously removing the obstacles to health, that those two things are enough to actually help people reduce their chemical sensitivity and eliminate their chemical sensitivity. It's especially helpful in my experience for people who can't tolerate some of the more difficult like protocols that people are putting them on, including things with like binders, which is not your approach. You take a much gentler approach, which is why I wanted to talk to you about this, versus some of the other people who are like heavy hitters. Let's bring in lots of chemicals to address chemicals too, right? Like, think about that. Like, we need to think about what we're doing, what we're using.
Well, so, you know, I think the logic behind this, and you know, I talk about this all the time, and like, if we believe that kids with PANS, PANDAS, kids with autism, that part of the underlying fundamental problem is that they are just not good detoxifiers. And I would argue anyone with chronic illness, that's probably true. So if we accept that's true, then the more stuff we give, even very well-intended, like I said, herbs and nutrients, you know, most of this still has to go through the liver. So if we have a tax detox system and we're asking the body to process more stuff, again, does it cause more harm than good? And look, I have certainly been guilty of giving probably more things to kids than I should have. You know, I'm human and I make mistakes too. And then I step back and realize, I'm like, good Lord, what am I doing? I'm like, this kid's already like so toxic and they've got 12 supplements and maybe this isn't such a smart approach. But, you know, I think, again, we have to be very cautious with the kids who are sensitive, that less is more. And, you know, even if you are using these other things, again, often you can use lower doses, you can use small amounts, because again, it doesn't take much to move things in the right direction. And it's so easy that, well, I've used these things at these doses for other people who weren't as sensitive and it worked. You know, doesn't apply to these kids who are generally more sensitive. You know, you've just got to go in with kid gloves and use a much more gentle approach.
And I just want to acknowledge that, like, there's nothing that's 100% and like are fully universal in anything with health and healing, right? And so I need to acknowledge that, you know, you mentioned, and I know you practice low dose immunotherapy with the sublingual. So it's a little bit different than like just regular, like not potentized sublingual immunotherapy. You use a potentized version. And so we do talk about, like, it's called low dose immunotherapy. It's LDI is the short for it. It is not something that is actually compatible with classical homeopathy. It does seem to disrupt the response. So oftentimes you can't use both of them together for most people, in my experience. However, there's some people that, use LDI and then come to classical homeopathy, because, because they want to desensitize more quickly to something and then work on the overall susceptibility and healing as a whole. So I just feel like I need to acknowledge that there are multiple ways to get there. Some things cannot be used together. That said, people need to find what works for them. But I always appreciate the gentlest approach that we can take. One other comment about homeopathy that I think is really important, especially in the PANS PANDAS community, is that like the getting fiber into kids can be really tough, especially with those ARFID kids, right? Homeopathy, because it works on the whole person and the totality, so it's going to address the susceptibility, not just to chemical one, chemical two, or what, or chemical three. It's going to address susceptibility as a whole. It can take longer to get to recovery because it's addressing the totality. But as part of that, it's also going to help. It generally helps people expand food acceptance. So we can, without having to force it necessarily, right? Because you can't force a kid with ARFID to eat. They will starve before they will eat, right? So we need something that can gently help their body get to a place where they can accept more food so that they can have more fiber-rich food, so they can help with their detox pathways and all of those things. So I just felt like that was an important thing to acknowledge too, to the parents who are like, but my kid won't eat fiber. What are you talking about? It's beige.
Well, again, I have no vested interest in this company, but Master Supplements makes a product called True Fiber. It's odorless, colorless, tasteless. It's a really easy thing to get in kids who are super picky and won't take like psyllium husk and really nasty forms of fiber. So I've liked that for kids just
As
because
a stopgap.
it's just a nice stopgap to get some fiber in them if they're really picky eaters and won't eat. And again, I find in my practice, when I get kids away from their food sensitivities, again, their diet expands. It's almost like a drug addiction. Once you get them off the addiction, now they're more open to accepting new foods, expanding their diet. But yeah, more than one ways to address the problem. But
Absolutely.
I like the fact that homeopathy can be a way to help open the doors to get kids to eat more food.
I feel like as we're closing out here, I want to just speak to any moms or dads that might be missing or listening to this, and in this chemical sensitive world with their child, because it's such a hard place to be in and it's super overwhelming. I just want to make sure that everyone knows that this thing, there is something you can do about it. It is absolutely healable. I had a child that for 3 years of her life, the first 3 years of her life, I could not take her outside of my home. There was no grocery store, there was no restaurant, there was no being around someone without them being like not in certain washed detergent, perfumes, fragrances. She could not live in the world at all. And today she is in a middle school volleyball locker room with people spraying perfume, and she's able to tolerate that. She's tolerating the world. She's living a normal life. She goes to school. She can go to the grocery store now. She can go into a restaurant, all those things. It's a long road, but healing is so very possible from this stuff. Even though it's an overwhelming place to begin, go seek it, like seek healing, because it can and will get better.
And I think that what we can say is the like definite thing we all three agree on is the body is really capable of some really powerful things if we give it the right support and the right nudges that we can, the body, if we just got to trust our bodies, it can do more than you think it can do. And it can heal in a really profound way when you have trust and do the right things, remove the obstacles, stimulate healing, desensitize the specific things, et cetera. Dr. Ingalls, I'm always grateful to talk to you. Always grateful for your insights. Thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything else you'd like to share, including where people can find you?
Well, they can always find us just at my website, which is just darreningallsnd.com, and all of our information's there, practice information. And yeah, I would just encourage, families that have been struggling, with chemical sensitivity, that there are options for it. Again, immunotherapy can be an incredibly powerful way to help, desensitize kids so that they can better function in the world. Because again, as much as we do our best to keep our home safe, the outside world is still kind of a scary place to be. And for kids who are sensitive, we just need to help them adapt to the world as best as possible.
All right, we'll make sure we've got links to all the ways to find you in our show notes. So thank you again for joining us.
All right, thank you.
All right,
Thank
take care,
you.
guys.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We would love to connect with you on social media and have you as part of our amazing community. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas.
If Facebook isn't your thing, you can also connect with us on Instagram and YouTube by searching for Resilience Naturopathic or clicking the links in our show notes. You can also visit our website, resiliencenaturopathic.com.
As always, we value your partnership in advocacy and education. Your support through following, sharing, rating, and reviewing our podcast is crucial in our mission to teach the world about PANS, PANDAS, and homeopathy. So if you found this podcast helpful, please leave us a review. Together, we are making a difference.
And finally, this podcast really is for you. Your questions and feedback help us make sure we are answering the right questions so you can feel confident making the next right step for your kids. Send us your questions or request guests by emailing us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com, also linked in the show notes.